I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about poverty. Some places in Indianapolis and central Indiana are seeing poverty rates increase, even though the state's jobs numbers seem good. We'll discuss the why of this. My guests are Indianapolis Chamber Chief Policy Officer Mark Fisher and Indianapolis Business Journal reporter Haley Colombo. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about poverty today on No Limits, and specifically about why we're seeing some increases in poverty rates here in Indianapolis and in parts of central Indiana, even though most of the other economic numbers look fairly good. It's an important subject, and if you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce Chief Policy Officer Mark Fisher, Indianapolis Business Journal reporter Haley Colombo, and Drew Classic, who is the senior researcher for the IU Public Policy Institute. Welcome to all of you. I guess I got two veterans and one newbie on today, so we'll try to be gentle, Haley, I promise.
Thanks for having me.
Certainly. Thank you all for being here. I'll start with Haley on this one. Give me a broad overview of what the picture looks like.
Sure. It's actually really shocking at a time when, state unemployment rate is, hovering over 3%, that we have, within the last 16 years or so, we've had a third of the city's zip codes actually lose income. We have several zip codes in Indianapolis where the poverty rate is, or where the unemployment rate is over 8%. We have 40% of Indianapolis residents living below the poverty line. So it's a pretty stark difference from some of the rosy numbers that, most people think about when they think about, how the economy is doing right now. A lot of people are just simply not participating in this new economy, and it's not necessarily working for them.
Drew, in part, and these numbers, I should say, are not a sudden development. We've seen this coming for a while. Several groups have released studies in recent years showing the poverty rates, not just in Indianapolis, but in Indiana overall, have been climbing even as the jobless numbers were dropping. And, 3%, at least on some scales, approaches, consideration what's considered full employment. And normally jobs are supposed to solve the poverty problem. Don't seem to be in this case, right?
Right. It's almost as if we're making progress while falling farther behind, and it depends on what side of your divide you're on. So we're doing a great job of growing high-wage, high-skill jobs, and we're doing a great job of growing the service economy. But in the middle of the economy, which has traditionally been what supported the middle class, which are basically labor-based jobs, those have started to shrink in terms of volume. And also, we typically now tend to not grow as much in the manufacturing sector, which has reasonably high wages, and we grow a lot more in the distribution sector, which are still important jobs but pay $20,000, $25,000 less than manufacturing. And so we're kind of barbelling our economy.
What kind of stresses is this? Mark, the term I have used for the evolution of this kind of economy, they're referring to it as the hourglass economy, where there's a bulge at the top and a bulge at the bottom and not as much in the middle. How is that going to change the way Indianapolis and Indiana operate?
Sure. So you really have to understand how we as a community built our economy. Through World War II and especially post-World War II, It was relatively low skill, but relatively high pay for that skill level. Manufacturing is still an incredibly important part of our economy, but the skills needed to fill those middle class manufacturing jobs are different, inherently different than a generation ago. And so, as our economy evolves, we've lost a lot of manufacturing jobs. Only Cleveland and Detroit have seen a larger exodus of manufacturing from the urban core than Indianapolis. And so when those jobs have left, 90% of the jobs in manufacturing we've lost in the past decade in our region are in Indianapolis alone. They've been replaced, more than replaced in the raw numbers, but in industries that are paying about a third less. So the transportation, distribution, logistics industries. And it's not just the fundamental shift in the nature of our economy, but also where those jobs are located. So people are having to travel further and further away to work for less money. And that is especially true in neighborhoods that already are experiencing high rates of poverty. So it's this spatial mismatch of where we're creating jobs versus where people are living. And we're not adequately addressing stuff like integrated workforce housing throughout the region or regional transportation and workforce mobility throughout the region. So we have to be thinking not just about the city, but how we are as an economy going to evolve on a regional basis.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about poverty and why certain parts of Indianapolis actually are seeing increases in poverty when, you know, the overall picture for the economy would seem to be relatively good. Although, as we've already discussed, the looks in some cases can be deceptive. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, Haley, you've done a lot of the reporting on this. Where, when we talk about these neighborhoods and areas that actually are losing ground, where are they and what traits do they share in common?
They're actually all over the city. So that's very interesting. However, part of my reporting has focused on the zip code 46218, which contains Martindale-Brightwood neighborhood, which, you know, is one of the poorest neighborhoods in the city. And 46218, that zip code actually has the highest poverty rate in the city. And, you know, they are already experiencing poverty, but they're also losing ground. So it's almost like they're falling behind. And, you know, there seems to be a lot of residents there who want to improve things, but, you know, there's a lot going on there. There's, you know, not a lot of access to high paying jobs, especially jobs that people have the skills to do. There's people who, you know, maybe are in a low-paying job right now, but they don't necessarily have the time or resources to, you know, put their kids in childcare or get to a degree program or something to make, you know, get better skills. There's, you know, the criminal justice system issues. There's, you know, there's racism elements of this that have been, you know, occurring over the decades. There's just disinvestment. There's a lot of sort of onion peel layers on this that are causing a, you know, a decline.
Mark, this would seem to, because I want to come back to the fact that the jobs numbers for the state look good. And at least one of the operative economic theories was that a rising tide is supposed to lift all boats. But in this case, some of them not only seem stuck, but they're actually sinking even further. Could we talk a little bit about, you know, what that is doing? I mean, to use the cliche, it sounds like in many ways the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And what brought us to this point?
Without a doubt. And this is not an Indianapolis only issue. In fact, We worked with the Brookings Institution. Drew is our research lead on getting a better handle on the causes of these increases in poverty. And what they did is they pulled, you know, 20, 30 cities together and said, look, we're seeing a lot of economic growth. We're seeing a lot of wealth creation, but we're also seeing rapid increases in poverty. And so really spent 6 months really digging in the data, looking about what are the causes, but also what are we doing to confront these challenges. And it is just it's how the history of our economy and how we've evolved, the impact of automation, the impact of increased robotics usage, and the skills that are going to be needed to earn those middle class jobs. And you know, looking at issues like concentrated poverty and what other barriers. We talk a lot about workforce development, and it is important, critically important, that we get the alignment right of our workforce system and how they work with the K-12 and higher ed systems. But as Haley mentioned, there are all these other barriers that people are facing to fully participate in the economy and the workforce, and they could be transportation, housing, health care, lack of child care. These issues that are the employees' problems are becoming the business problems because with a tight labor market, it is increasingly hard to fill the jobs that we have open now. And so, you know, I like to not just talk about the unemployment rate, but the workforce participation rate. And I think that's a number that we really have to think about. While we as a state have a workforce participation rate of 64%, which is about a point and a half or 2 points higher than the national average, if you think about it, that means 36% of our able-bodied Hoosiers are not even looking for a job. In many cases, they have given up hope and have dropped out of actively seeking. And so you start to see the impact of multiple generations of people that aren't working and what happens when you have concentrated intergenerational poverty. One of the things that Brookings helped us as a business community, a lot of people might say, well, yeah, what took you so long? Better understand is the complexities of poverty and what is going to be a cause of long-term concentrated intergenerational poverty. One of the things that we looked at is how many households don't even have a worker in the family. And so as children are raised in households without a worker in the family, how are they developing their skill sets? How are they developing work ethic and stuff like that? So we're looking not, and you know, the United Way does a good job of this, of addressing poverty on a two-generational strategy. You can't just treat the child that's in poverty or look at the parent that is in poverty. You've got to really start to treat even multi-generational, not just two-generation poverty.
Drew, I know there are many economists. You know, Mark's already alluded to the fact that there, for in certain industries, businesses, there's a labor shortage already that we're confronting. There's supposed to be, according to many economists, a worldwide labor shortage that's going to hit sometime around 2030. And in many ways, that's just a math problem now because everybody who's going to be in the workforce in 2030 is alive now. So we have a pretty good idea of the available pool. So it sounds like that's going to create some sort of stress on this trend already. Has your research shown anything about what effect it might have? Will it make this trend even more significant? Or,
well, in some ways, the two trends combine to create enormous opportunity. And so we're in the Midwest, which means our labor force is going to be getting older and smaller faster than the world as a whole, which means we're going to need human capital sooner. And we have this group of people that are disconnected from the economy for all the reasons we've talked about so far, about 100,000 children in poverty, 100,000 adults without a high school education, and another 250,000 adults in jobs that make them income or employment insecure. If we can find a way to better connect their aspirations to the modern economy, then we actually solve a lot of our long-term workforce issues without having to reach beyond our borders, which I find to be a really exciting opportunity.
Is it one of those things, though, that can we grow our own to meet this problem, or are we going to have to find a way to attract new workers?
I think the answer is why not both, almost in all cases, but the exciting thing about this Brookings project that we worked on was the realization that we have the ability to create that win-win, where we can create an opportunity for folks to make better lives for their children while enabling them to develop the skills necessary to connect to the economy, which is kind of that win-win. So developing our own, plus then, as we grow our economy, looking outside to continue to grow Central Indiana and Indiana.
We are talking today on No Limits about poverty in Indianapolis and Central Indiana, and about why we're seeing increases in some areas. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce Chief Policy Officer Mark Fisher, Indianapolis Business Journal reporter Haley Colombo, and Drew Classic, who is the senior researcher for the Indiana University Public Policy Institute. We're going to take a break now, but when we come back, we're going to deal with a couple of questions, email questions we've gotten from listeners about really misperceptions about the poor and how we combat those. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.
Good day.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about poverty today, specifically about why we're seeing poverty rates increase in parts of Indianapolis and central Indiana. My guests are Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce Chief Policy Officer Mark Fisher, Indianapolis Business Journal reporter Haley Colombo, and Drew Classic, senior researcher for the Indiana University Public Policy Institute. We've gotten several emails. I'm going to start with one from our regular listener, Jerry. Again, our email address, if you want to join the conversation that way, is nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, middle and upper class Americans are generally not even aware that poor Americans pay more for almost everything from food, employment opportunity, and toilet paper to health care, education, and financial services. There is a hidden surcharge for everything that requires basic transportation and or good credit. Worse, this poverty tax is the source of much of the wealth of the wealthiest among us. Can this tax be repealed without significant amendments to the current redistribution of wealth, which already favors giving more to those who already have the most? Drew, I'll start with you on that one.
Well, I think the answer is yes, if we're careful about it. And I would guess that Mark would first want to talk about mass transit and how we can use mass transit to, in part, overcome that tax by making more options available to the consumer. I had a class that actually did a report on Washington Street, and they were stunned to find that as the income of a census tract went up, the price of milk went down. And the question was why, and the answer is competition. And so if we have mass transit, you can afford to go beyond your small neighborhood store and buy that $1.99 gallon of milk instead of a $2.99 gallon of milk, right? So mass transit might be one way. Another way to address the poverty tax would be to address housing policy, where economic segregation, in a sense, limits the options of where poor people live and kind of drives them into the neighborhoods where that tax exists.
I think you were cued there, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, it is certainly very expensive, both for the individual and society at large, to be poor. Mm-hmm. Right? You think about access to healthcare. One of the functions of poverty we looked at is, do you have access to health insurance or health care? And if you don't, the fact is you're not treating chronic diseases and they're only getting worse. The workforce, the health of our workforce directly correlates to the productivity, reduced absenteeism. The overall health of our workforce does impact our ability to grow economically. And so we do have to be thinking about stuff like food deserts and access to healthy food. We have to be thinking about social determinants of health, how tobacco is marketed and is more widely available in low-income communities. These are all issues that contribute to poverty. And certainly the callers this idea that a lot of upper middle class, wealthy individuals don't realize what's happening. We found that in our research, and we found that as we've gone out and presented our data, that we have economically segregated ourselves as a region, and that allows people to not be exposed to the broader and and really the depths of some of the more systemic challenges we face as a community.
But I also want to get to, Jerry's question, the spirit of that is also there is a, well, I can't think of another term for it, but there often are predatory practices when it comes to dealing with the poor. I'm going to come to Haley on it first because she nodded her head. But, you know, I remember years ago when I was in grad school in St. Louis and living in an apartment, there was a small little market that was just around the corner from my apartment where, you know, most of us did our shopping. But I noticed pretty early on in my stay there that the prices jumped dramatically at a certain point, and it's because there were a couple of retirement communities there. They delivered food, the folks in those retirement communities, so they increased the prices by 10% right before the Social Security checks arrived, which, you know, is just, you know, blatantly predatory. Do we see stuff like that now, Haley?
Absolutely. I think that's part of the fabric of some of these neighborhoods. Some of the most prevalent businesses in poor neighborhoods are check cashing, stores. And I was shocked when I was reading through the chamber report about the, I think it's 11% of Indianapolis residents are unbanked. And then we have 18% of Indianapolis residents that are underbanked. And that is a problem because they're then having to rely on, really high interest rates in terms of if they want to get a loan. There's loan sharking type situations happening. So it's this other idea of it's expensive to be poor. They're not even necessarily getting credit in the same way the rest of us are.
So just to clarify, those stats are actually on our metro level. It's more in Indianapolis, Marion County, it's closer to 18% of the population doesn't have a bank account.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is expensive to live outside of the mainstream traditional financial system. And certainly financial literacy. And one of the things that we talk to employers about is what you can do to help make your employees' life outside of the workplace easier makes them more loyal, more productive. So teaching your providing financial literacy classes, bringing in financial institutions to enroll your employees in your services and in your bank or whatever it is, you know, you have to start helping solve for whatever the challenges that an employee faces outside the work, especially in a tight labor market. And certainly financial literacy is a huge, huge issue that we face as a community.
Got a related question here also by email. And again, if you want to join the conversation by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can call us at 866-476-3881. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. This comes from another regular listener, Sean. Sean writes, having had a mother who worked for the FSSA for over 30 years and me having multiple disabilities my whole life and living in HUD housing for 20 years, I can tell you that poor people do work, whether it's volunteer work or intermittent jobs. This myth that poor people are lazy, that Reagan and the Flying Monkey Right started a long time ago, is to divide us. It is not that I can't work, won't work. I can't work and still afford the health care I need to stay alive because I will no longer qualify for government assistance. A mere $200 a month health care costs to really throw one off. If they want us to work, provide everyone with health care for every person. I want to work more than I want to walk. The people who are in favor of this should hang around a HUD building for a few months, and they'll quickly learn that they have been lied to about how we live. And finally, corporate welfare costs taxpayers much more than social welfare. This is from Sean. Yeah, Haley, you want to grab that one?
I'd like to sort of piggyback on this idea that there's a misconception about poor people not working. I spoke with met a family who's living at Day Spring Shelter here in Indianapolis. They're living in a homeless shelter, and they're both parents are regularly working. Mm. And the mom of the family is a waitress downtown. And, you know, they got their car towed away and they can't sort of afford to get it out right now and to repair it. So she takes the bus. You know, she makes a $2-something an hour wage job as a waitress and relies on tips. So sometimes the money's good and sometimes it wasn't even worth it to go to work that day based on the bus fare that she paid. So there's this. You know, there's this sort of, yeah, there's a myth that poor people aren't working. A lot of them are working, but they're making very little or they're making wages that you can't necessarily depend on. Or there's a lot of these, you know, jobs that are available, maybe paying $9-10 an hour. People are not finding it even worth it to go get those jobs, which I feel like is just something that we all need to sort of think about why that may be, how much life costs and if you're finding a job just not even worth it to take.
Drew, it strikes me, the numbers that I have seen, not just in this, but in some of the other reports I've looked at, also sort of supports what Haley is saying. There are a lot of people on that lower end who are working and working incredibly hard, but often, you know, they're working two or three jobs and still not able to keep up.
But not just not keep up. We did a project called Thriving Communities, Thriving States.
Mm-hmm.
And what we learned
and
in
we've
that
done
project
a couple of shows on that.
Was, and one of the things that I'll never forget is that it doesn't matter where you live in Indiana. What you have in common is that you want to believe your child's life will be better than yours. And so whether you're rich or you're poor, whether you're urban or you're rural, you want that. And when you're making $10 an hour and most of that's going to daycare, you don't believe you have the ability to make your child's life better than yours. And if you don't believe it, your child also doesn't believe it. And so you start get this compounding of barriers that all go back to the fact that the cost of living and many of the jobs that people that are working two, three, and four different jobs at, the wages don't add up to the ability to make their child's life better. One last point. One of the really hardest things about poverty is how it forces you to think hard about tomorrow instead of mm-hmm. next year or the next decade. And so mm-hmm. when you're worried about electricity or tomorrow's dinner, mm-hmm. it's really hard to think about the kinds of investment in education or anything else you need to make your child's life better 10 years from now. And so it's really easy when you think about it, to look backwards and to understand how economic insecurity can have long-term effects, not just on the adult, but also on the child in the household.
Gotten another email from a listener named Cliff. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Cliff writes, what are the differences, if any, between being broke and being poor? Mark?
Yeah. So, you know, the United Way has done a lot of work on this. They call it ALICE, Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Yet Employed. It is a really fancy name for the working poor. And if you take the people that are considered ALICE, classified as ALICE, which is about 26% of the Marion County population, and then another 19% are living in poverty, you've got 45% of the Marion County population that are on the cusp, are either living in poverty or on the cusp of living in poverty. And so they're one car accident or one illness away from losing their job. That's why proximity to jobs is such a huge issue. If you are having to travel, if you are transit dependent and have to travel an hour and a half one way via bus because of the current limitations on the service, that is hour and a half one way, hour and a half back. That's 3 hours of your day that you're not spending with your family. You're not in school getting a different credential. You're not exercising. You're not volunteering in your community. You're not reading to your child. And so that long commute is certainly a deterrent for many people. We, as part of our process with Brookings, interviewed 20 companies, and every single company we talked to had people quit because of the benefits cliff. The idea that once they hit a certain income threshold, they lose their child care, their CCDF vouchers. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a employer issue. Turnover, employee turnover at 40-50%, or if you're in the trucking industry, 100%+ a year, is extremely expensive for companies. And so thinking about access to jobs, both through housing, through transportation, through proactive brownfield remediation, bringing companies back into the urban core, are all policies that we need to be really considering, and not just on a community-by-community basis, but on a regional basis.
How much of this, because we've seen a couple of these questions relating to healthcare, and we've mentioned it in the conversation, and I'm thinking of a conversation I had with a couple of businessmen from – one was from the UK and the other was from Canada, and they were both very conservative. The guy from the UK would have been quite happy to resurrect Margaret Thatcher and put her back as prime minister, and the guy from Canada was a huge Stephen Harper fan. But they said that they really didn't understand the knots the United States, people in the United States, tie themselves into regarding health care. They said, if you do have a government system like that, it actually makes life simpler for businesses because you have far fewer things to negotiate with employees and all of that sort of stuff, and it's just taken off the board. We've had a couple of these emails where they say, this is a major obstacle. It would be a lot easier for me to work if I didn't have to worry about health care. Drew, I'll ask you.
For certain, preventative medicine is always more effective than reactive medicine. And if you don't have health insurance, you don't get the privilege of preventative medicine. My dad died when we were young and we got poor, and I didn't go to the dentist unless I had a terrible cavity for about 6 years. And I still am dealing with those issues, right? And what I didn't think about was that it meant that any time I was ill because I didn't get preventative medicine, my mom missed a day of work. Mm-hmm. And we don't. If you're privileged and you have health care, you don't think about how important it is to proactively intervene rather than have to wait till your child's so sick that you have no choice but to rush them to the doctor. And when you're hourly, that's a loss of income in addition
to – So it's a double whammy. Yes. It's one another one of those tax – yeah, Mark.
But there are also this concept of social determinants of health, right? What are contributing factors that lead to poor health outcomes – based off of zip code, right? The Fairbanks School of Health, Public Health at IU, has a really scary map I think you can find on their website. If you live on the south side of Indianapolis, you have a 14-year life expectancy difference than the people that live on the north side of Indianapolis. Hamilton County is consistently ranked the healthiest county in Indiana, where Marion County is either dead last or close to dead last. What is it about zip codes, right? And it's higher rates of smoking. It's not proactively treating your chronic diseases. That's why a lot of companies have gotten into the in-house health clinic business, right? We have a great company that is an entrepreneur company in headquartered in downtown Indianapolis that partners with businesses for their in-house health clinics, right? That is one of those employee benefits that companies are realizing if they can proactively treat and help their employees quit smoking, eat healthier, live a healthier lifestyle, and proactively treat some of their chronic diseases, they're going to have a more productive workforce.
But Haley, in your reporting, I mean, how often did you find that people said that this was a disincentive or at least a barrier toward them? To be able to access that in-house health clinic, you have to be on the job in the first place. So.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, all of us can think about everyone has different healthcare struggles, different healthcare needs, and it's tough to handle when you do have a good job. So imagine when you don't. Imagine when you have no flexibility. Imagine when no one is looking out for you and say, oh, yeah, just take the morning off and go do that. And I do think I was talking to some folks in a neighborhood where the life expectancy was much lower than other parts of the city. And when I bring that up, they're not necessarily shocked by that, but obviously there's a sense of unfairness there. Why are people here living shorter? I mean, it's just this basic sense of unfairness about, the world we have and the world we live in.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about poverty here in Indianapolis and in central Indiana. My guests are Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce Chief Policy Officer Mark Fisher, Indianapolis Business Journal reporter Haley Colombo, and Drew Classic, Senior Researcher for the Indiana University Public Policy Institute. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about poverty in Indianapolis today on No Limits. My guests are Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce Chief Policy Officer Mark Fisher, Indianapolis Business Journal reporter Haley Colombo, and Drew Classic, senior researcher for the Indiana University Public Policy Institute. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Francine has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Francine, you're on the line.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I wanted to understand, and I think someone hinted at this a little bit, are there any studies about the quality of life for impoverished families and that overall impact on the community? I think I heard a little bit about life expectancy, but what about the quality of life if a parent, or if they can't be there because they're working all the time, or they can't provide access to health care because they can't afford it? What future impact does that then have on that particular community and maybe our state as a whole?
Thanks very much for the call and the great question, Francine. Drew, I'll start with you on that one.
Well, the answer is there have been a lot of studies, and so it's hard to summarize them in a talking point. But there was a person named Ray Chetty who basically identified five overlapping barriers that made it more difficult for families to believe, for parents to believe their children's life could be successful and better than theirs. And they were the absence of health insurance, the absence of an employed person in the household, the educational attainment of the neighborhoods, of the neighbors that surrounded them, and a couple other factors, and I can't remember.
Living in concentrated poverty.
And the challenge becomes, when you grow up in that environment, how do you overcome the lack of social capital that is presented in front of you? And if you look at it now from overall society, and this sounds overly simplistic, but some folks consume taxes and other folks produce taxes. And if we can do a better job of helping individuals attain their potential, then we, in a sense, reduce the number of tax consumers and increase the number of tax producers, which in the aggregate is beneficial for everyone. Children's lives are better, and we have more ability to invest in even a higher quality of life.
We're talking about poverty today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Gary has done and find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Gary writes, good afternoon. As one anecdotal individual living in Indianapolis with an MBA and a concentration in global supply chain management, he says $1,270 is an hour is all I have found, and he's dealing with federal student loans. He says the human capital argument does not or has not worked for someone coming from impoverishment. Mark, your thoughts.
You know, one of the benefits that we've had working on this project with Drew and the Brookings Institution is it has caused us or given us reason to go out and talk to entities that we're not traditionally aligned with and really think about how it's not us versus them, but how we're going to all work together to solve some of these. So one of the best groups that we've been able to work with on these poverty issues is the Indiana Institute for Working Families. Are we always going to see eye to eye on policy issues or solutions? Mm-hmm. No, but really trying to find where we can find common ground. Certainly, they've done a lot of work around what does it actually take to live subsidy-free in Indianapolis? And I think it's a lot higher than people think. For a single mother of two, one pre-age and one grade school child, to live subsidy-free in Marion County, this doesn't include the nine-county region, it's $23.15 an hour. It's about $49,000 a year. And so certainly the conversations about our workforce shortage, being more attractive to outside talent is something that we all need to be concerned about. We're drawing most of our people from the rest of Indiana. We're not competitive on a global scale where we need to be, but we can't just rely, and we'll never be able to attract our way out of the workforce issue. So we have to find strategies to lift up the people that are disconnected from the economy. The Opportunity Youth Initiative coming out of Employee Indy is really key for those younger kids that are disconnected. They're not in school. They're not in employment. And so it's got to be a comprehensive, all hands on deck approach. But really, how do we tackle that 36% of the population that is completely disconnected from the workforce right now?
Gotten an email from a listener named Jerry. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, one major reason that there is a skills shortage for potential workers is that they are short on the basic requirements. That is that they have been shorted the skills taught in the old systems in the lower grades at school, such as reading and writing cursive, phonics, and basic math. These are absolute minimums necessary to progress. Haley, I mean, we hear two different kinds of arguments on that. One is that we do need to go back to basics in education. The other is, obviously, that the entire educational system needs to be overhauled and that we need to stop preparing young people for jobs that don't exist any longer and start preparing them for new ones. Are both true?
Maybe a little bit. I think there's, obviously there's some, basics that are absolutely critical. Reading skills. I think, during our state and city debate about preschool in the last couple of years, hearing about just the, when you're a poor child, the number of words that you hear is significantly less than someone who is, has a higher wage, and how that just impacts you later on in life. So I think there are some of those basic issues in terms of reading and writing that are critical and that we really need to be focusing on, and we're not. I mean, we also have a significant number of people who, even if they get to college, they need remedial work. And how does that affect them if they're getting to college, but they're not even taking the courses that will allow them to get to their skill, to get to their credential, and they're sort of stuck retaking English, retaking math, that sort of thing. That sets them behind. That's more money for them before they're, out earning their wage. I mean, there is an education piece of this that is extremely critical. Is everyone across the city getting access to the same quality of education? And are there some just other barriers that we have in the city that keeps people who are poor, maybe, even if they have access to a great school or a great teacher, are they hungry? Have they not slept the night before? There's factors that are just keeping people behind.
Mark. Certainly, from the Chamber's perspective, everything we know about brain development, childhood brain development, is one of the reasons we've been big advocates for expanding high-quality outcomes-based pre-K. But also, I think we as a state kind of went from okay, everybody's fine with a high school degree. Now everybody's got to get a four-year degree. Doesn't matter what it is, as long as you get a four-year degree. So we overproduce in four-year degrees in areas that don't jive with our economy or are not going to be jobs that provide a solid middle-class training, or lifestyle. So I think one of the things that we need to look at, and I know the state and the governor and everybody's really talking about this workforce alignment, but I think what Denver and Colorado are doing around apprenticeships and allowing for this permeability. So you get into a track where you can get into high school and apprenticeships, and as you graduate, you have an associate's degree, you have a certification, go right into a high-paying job. But, what if you decide you didn't really want to do that and you want to go to a four-year institution? So designing a system that allows for that permeability. We hear a lot of talk about, the apprenticeships and skilled trades. And I also hear a lot of parents saying, oh, that's great, just not for my kid because he's going to a four-year institution. So how we align our system to allow that transferability that permeability between the educational systems and then the stackability, making sure that you're always getting credit that will lead to a degree or certificate, I think from a workforce development standpoint is going to be critical. But we've got to address, it's not addressing pre-K versus higher ed versus workforce. It's that continuum from pre-K all the way through employment and post-employment. What Brooklyn says, the number one attribute that you need to have in a workforce is this adaptability, constantly upskilling. And so that's it's not, it's a continuum. It's not you take care of one and you're going to solve for all the other issues.
We're getting a lot of questions floating in, so I'm going to ask both callers, folks who are sending emails and all of that, and even my distinguished panel here, to try to be tight so that we give as many people a chance as possible to talk. We're talking about poverty today. You want to join the conversation, you can do what Art has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Art, you're on the air.
Thank you. My point is that I think we need to focus even younger. We ought to focus on kids, say, 10 or 11 and younger before they become parents and try to enlighten them on what it really means to be any older than that age and the things that might befall them if they should encounter a pregnancy or whatever, or a drug problem if they're tempted that way too. But we need to have kids that are older, that are respected as peers, go back into the schools, a whole cohort that can do that and that can connect with the kids on their terms and help to produce the mindset over a period of time that makes them receptive to everything else the schools are trying to accomplish.
Thanks very much for the call, Art. I'm going to try to get a response for you real quickly. Thank you. So a large part of what Art seemed to be talking about, Haley, also is the early childhood development, and that can be another class-driven thing. You know, middle class, upper middle class, and obviously even wealthier families can afford to, get their kids intellectual stimulation, when they're 2-3 years old, and that's not an option for a lot of poor people. How great a divide does that create?
I think, the benefits of early childhood education seem to be pretty clear. It seems to be really positive for the child as they grow up and as they, there's fewer run-ins with the, criminal justice system. There's all of the, there's higher incomes. There's all of these benefits that have been shown. But another thing that I feel like we don't talk about as much, I did an article on this, maybe about a year ago, was through our preschool program that we've passed here, even though it's a small amount of kids, it's sort of been shown to help the parents of those kids obtain a job, improve their lives. So it's again, focusing on that two-generational piece. It's not just, what benefit could that have for the child? It's about, freeing up time, freeing up expense for their parent to be able to better themselves.
We've gotten a question from a listener named Tom via Facebook, and you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Tom writes, as I've been listening, I haven't heard anyone talk about those who can't pass a drug screen to get a job. How does that affect those who could work but can't because of addiction? Drew and Mark, I'd like the two of you to tackle that one, because it does seem, okay, you got someone who's in a bad position already. Continuing to be jobless is likely to make the situation even worse.
Certainly our tax structure in Indiana does not necessarily allow us to make long-term investments in mental and behavioral health professionals. We saw the report from DCS yesterday. We can't produce social workers fast enough or mental and behavioral health professionals fast enough to keep pace. We're 36 out of 50 per capita on behavioral and mental health professionals in our community. So we need to be treating this as an addiction and mental health issue. But, this is a nationwide epidemic with the opioids. And it's troubling when you start to see employers, and we have seen them, put up billboards saying, we don't drug test. or they create two classes of workers. If you want to work full time, get higher pay, and you want benefits, you have to pass a drug test. But if you just want to work a few hours and fill a shift, no drug test. I mean, that's how tight the labor market is right now, and so. Certainly, we need to take on the scourge of drugs and its impact on our economy and our workforce.
We're starting to get tight on time. I want to get a last email in from a listener named Kim. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Gallup polls 700,000 students every year, Kim writes. Over half are not hopeful about their futures. If our society doesn't fix that, we will soon become no better than a third world country, and the prospects for prosperity and security become a distant mirage. I think Drew alluded to this earlier when he talked about, you know, how the long-term implications of this. Part of this, Kim, and I may be taking some liberties too, when we talk about the hourglass economy, that's a fine point of saying, in some ways, we're on the verge of no longer being a middle-class society. And the middle class was one of the things that gave a very varied nation, diverse one, some element of social cohesion. What are we looking at if, in fact, the middle class is beginning to disappear? I'll start with Drew on that.
So Kim makes a very good point. The absence of hope can be crippling. I think when we rebranded our Brookings work, we called it Reconnecting to the American Dream to basically make that exact symbolism. And then you bring up the middle class issue. That middle class, the hourglass, the thin part of the hourglass, the labor part, was the hope, because you could, in a generation, transform your family from immigrant family with limited education, my grandparents, to my dad going to Purdue. That was made possible by a place called Standard Oil that was right in the middle of that hourglass. Without those kinds of generationally transformative jobs, it's harder and harder to have hope. And when you don't have hope, it's harder and harder to make the appropriate investments for the long term.
Mark, I'm going to give you about 30 seconds so that Haley's got a little bit of time to have the last word.
There's still a lot of middle-class jobs out there, but the skills needed to fill those jobs are fundamentally different, and we also must start to systematically address the barriers, if it's housing, transportation, health care, child care. All of these things aren't just an employee's issues. They are the employer's issues as well.
Okay, Haley, you're going to get the last word here, and you've got about 45 seconds to deliver it.
Okay. Well, something that, you know, people have been asking us, why is the Business Journal writing about...
No Limits is
writing about this, and what I've, you know, thought about is, just because you don't have any power in the economy, just because you're impoverished, just because you're working a very, you know, sort of low-end job, doesn't make you any less any less part of the economy than people who have power. It's just that the economy is not working for you. So I think that if we care about this as a region and as a city, that we need to do a better job of helping people connect and helping the economy work more for everyone.
And that is an appropriate last word. I'd like to thank all three of you. I'd like to thank Mark Fisher, Haley Colombo, and Drew Classic for what has been a lively and provocative conversation about an important topic. As always, I want to thank our listeners for some great questions and comments. It's a lot of fun to do a talk radio show for the smartest audience in talk radio. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.